Well, I just I'm so fascinated by how these two pieces fit together. So you've brought us all the way up in the timeline to March of 1931 when Father Reynolds had already testified, had taken somewhat of a meek position in the prosecution's case, and seemingly, at least if he didn't bow, he bent to the wishes of the mob that he not testify against this guy Frankie Foster, who really did do the murder of this reporter and bagman for Al Capone, Lingle. So how does this in any way lead to the death of Knute Rockne?
Okay, you got to understand, during that week, that last week of the trial, Rockne came back from, he was vacationing with his family in Miami, and they had football, spring football practice started that week. So he came back early from vacation that week to oversee football practice. During that week, he gets a call from his agent, Christy Walsh, saying that there was a $50,000 offer on the table to go out to L.A. to consult, and I think even eventually it was to take part in the movie, The Spirit of Notre Dame. So anyway, Rockne, he needed a plane ticket, and because they wanted him out there the following week. He needed a plane ticket to get out to L.A. And he was like, he couldn't at the. This was 1930, not 1931. He couldn't, it just wasn't like he just.
It seems extraordinary that the guy who had already had five championships and had just beaten USC like a drum a couple months earlier for the national championship again, that he couldn't scrape together enough cash to get out to Hollywood to get on a you know to get become a consultant on set for a movie.
It wasn't a matter of money. It wasn't a matter of money.
Oh,
It
okay.
was just a matter of the availability of a ticket.
Oh, there just weren't that many planes and that many tickets.
Right. Well, it was basically the birth. It was the first like 5 or 6 years, the birth of the commercial aviation.
Okay, right.
And so anyway, he's trying, and a train would take too long, and he was in poor health. I mean, his health was really, really bad. I mean, to the point where he even had discussed not coaching in 1930, and but he did. He wound up
From what? From
phlebitis. He was
oh.
exhausted. Well, for one thing, he was just his body was exhausted. He was
Yeah.
running. He was running 20 round the clock on. He was a spokesman for Studebaker. He was on
Right.
the lecture circuit. He was running football schools. Plus, he was head football coach of the best football team in the country.
Right.
And he was 43 years old. He had the body of a 72-year-old. I mean, he was worn
Wow.
out. The doctors were telling him, "Do not travel." They
Right.
told the, his one doctor told him, if you go out to L.A., his doctor told him in December, if you go out to L.A., he says, you might as well just get a new doctor because I'm done with you."
Right.
And he called that off. But he had been checking in and out of the Mayo Clinic even.
Huh.
So he needs a ticket to go out to L.A.
And
So
that's when he bumps in, by chance, he bumps into his old friend, a guy he coached.
The
That,
day
yeah.
after Father Reynolds gets off the witness stand, Knute Rockne and Father John Reynolds bump into each other on campus on Notre Dame.
Amazing.
It's
And it just
exciting.
is a chance conversation where he says, I got this offer to go out to Hollywood to serve as a consultant on this movie, but I can't get out there in time because I don't have a plane ticket.
And Father Reynolds, who wanted to, who was. He had been he was doing work out in Oregon at another school up until he returned to Notre Dame in, I believe, 1927 or 28, and he wanted to get away from the after all he had been through. He wanted to get away and go out to Oregon and hike, and which was his favorite pastime. Well, the trial was still going on, so he couldn't leave. So he tells Rockne, he says, "I have a ticket, take mine." And the proof of that is in and I researched that to find actual documented proof. In January of 1989, in Vintage Plane magazine, retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Boardman C. Reed wrote that six passengers were on the manifest of that plane, of a 12-seat plane. One of those passengers had a change of plans at the last minute, and Canute Rockne took his place.
Wow. So verified that end of what could otherwise have been considered like some sort of urban legend.
Yes.
But the plane didn't fly out of Chicago.
No, the plane flew out of Kansas City. No, there was going to be a flight from Kansas City. Now, Rockne thought, it was around the time of Rockne's mother's birthday too. So he went to, he took the train to Chicago, I believe Sunday night, late Sunday night. And Monday spent some time with his mother. Then he spent some time with the Chicago Tribune sports reporter. Sports editor who was a friend of his, and Christy Walsh was with him and another friend, and they had dinner. Then Rockne catches the overnight train from Chicago to Kansas City, where he was going to visit. He was going to try to take a few minutes and visit his two boys. Bill and Canute Jr., who were in boarding school out there, but they were in Florida with their mother, and they were on a train coming back from Florida. And Rockne thought that he might be able to meet the train, you know, and spend a few minutes with them. So he gets out there at 7 o'clock. The boy and he gets picked up by his friend Dr. Nigro. And they have breakfast, and then they're waiting for the train to come in for his boys before his flight, which was supposed to leave at 8:30.
Okay.
But it gets to be around 8 o'clock, I think 8:05, and he finds out that the boys' train is going to be late. So he doesn't have time to see the boys, so he goes
right
out. And
so this is just a standard kind of thing where there's nothing nefarious about it. The boy's train was delayed, and so he's got to run to the airport and get on that plane
right
to get out to the West Coast.
Well, turns out his plane, which was supposed to leave at 8:30, was delayed for 45 minutes to wait for a late mail shipment. This is according to the official Department of Commerce official a crash investigation report that I got, which was only made public. I got it from Wright Air Force Base through a FOIA, and it wasn't made public until 2005, the official accident investigation report from the Rockne crash.
Hmm.
So that plane was delayed for 45 minutes. They removed four of those seats to make room for 28 pounds of mail, of late mail, which weighed 95 pounds.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Right.
So
six people on the plane. Newt Rockne's a last-minute substitution for Father Reynolds.
Yes.
And the plane takes off for Hollywood.
And the plane takes off,
for West Coast.
Now, you got to understand about the plane. Three days before the crash, the plane's manufacturer, Anthony Fokker, had signed off on the safety of the plane. But 3 months before that crash, the military had tested the Fokker F-10 at Wright Field in Dayton, and they had grounded that. They had recommended that plane be grounded because of the wings were unstable. The control mechanisms on the wings made the tail heavy, and the pilots were complaining that it flew like a duck. But the aeronautics branch of the Department of Commerce took no action. The plane was allowed to fly.
Okay.
So the plane comes in, and the pilot, Robert Fry, was an experienced U.S. Marine Corps airline pilot who was the most experienced he was the most experienced pilot in the country, and that was according to several people during the investigation, several pilots and co-pilots. Well, before when the plane did its regular route, came in from LA, the TWA mechanic, a guy named Red Long, inspected the plane and found that the wing panels were loose. He refused to sign off on the flight. He refused to put that plane in the air. But he was overruled by a TWA supervisor who was anonymous. This is according, again, to the official and to the DOC's official accident investigation report. The TWA supervisor overruled and overruled Redlong and signed off on that plane to get in the air. So again,
well, this is germane because this when later on people say, well, it was a plane, the plane had problems, that the plane had been recently inspected and the plane had been approved.
Yeah, but it also had been recommended to be grounded.
Got it.
And it was overruled, and it was even ground, and it was even the mechanic at the time refused to sign off on it. But then he was overruled by this supervisor, one of his superiors.
Okay.
So now you've got a TWA supervisor who knew, by the way, this last minute manifest. Who knew Knute Rockne was on that plane?
Hmm.
Now, you know, because of the last-minute claim. So, now, he knew that that plane was unsafe and that he was putting the most famous football coach in the country, one of the most famous sports figures in the country, you know, on a plane that was unsafe. Now, you know, somebody wanted him on that plane and wanted to put that plane in the air.
Mm. So you're feeling like this anonymous person that overrules that judgment is intentionally wants to make sure that it's Knute Rockne on that plane when it takes off. There's no longer a thought that it was Father Reynolds. So it's not a case of mistaken identity, that they knew it was Knute Rockne. And you're saying that even though the plane was inspected and even though it had been approved, that the approval is suspicious because it seems like somebody wants Knute to be on this plane, which later on gets called into question.
Before Father Reynolds took the stand, in the months before he took the stand, he received two anonymous notes saying, if you testify, Notre Dame will be more sorry than you realize.
Notre so not Dame. Even a direct threat to him, like, we're going to kill you.
It was Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
Exactly.
Okay, so the plane takes off.
So the plane takes off at about 10, the conditions, weather conditions are cold and cloudy. But there were, again, you had one of the most experienced pilots on it, flying that plane, who flew blindly one time over China in a dust storm in the Marines, and wound up surviving, you know, a dust storm over China, and even talking himself out of getting being taken prisoner. Anyway, you also had a national air transport plane flying alongside of it, like it was on the same path, and it was fine. It made its way into Wichita safely, and by the time it got to Wichita, the conditions were clear, and there was unlimited visibility for 7 miles.
Okay.
Now when the Rockne crash occurred, the first witnesses of Edward Baker, he crashed in the farm. There was a farm in Kansas. Now, one of the witnesses, a young man, actually a teenager named Edward Baker, told the first witness reports were that they heard a plane explode in the air. And a plane flying like 600 feet, flying low, they hear it explode. They see a wing, the wing sever and fall down and come to the ground. And it was located about a half mile, almost a mile away from the actual wreckage.
Hmm.
Now, and the first headlines. The first headlines even that day were that plane exploded. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania Sun Telegraph. Knute Rockne, 7 others die as planes explode. The Pittsburgh Press. Knute Rockne, 7 others die as plane explodes. And there was another paper in Red Bluff Daily News that said explosion on plane reported by farmer watching flight. The next day, those reports came back, the witness accounts came back as they were, you know, there was ice on the wing, and another one was the propeller had broken. that eventually were turned out to be unfounded, because both the coroner's jury and the Department of Investigations, Department of Commerce's investigation report, both were inconclusive. The findings were inconclusive. Let's see where.
Well, while you're searching for that, let me just say then, so that if we look at that in terms of how stories are reported today, it could have just been somebody was looking for the most sensational headline, or the other way that people look at it is the first version was the true version, and then other people get involved and say, you can't say that. So do we think, is there any reason to suspect what kind of bomb it was, who was the person who put it there, and has anything come down in history suggesting that it was, you know, let's go back to Frankie Foster again or Al Capone again? Was there anything that directly linked that the potential explosion of that plane to any of the previous villains we've discussed?
Yes.
Okay.
But first, let me stress this, that the plane went down at around 10:45. It took investigators, again, you're talking 1931, it took investigators, they didn't get to Cottonwood Falls or to the plane site until 7 o'clock that night. So you had all day long. Meanwhile, scavengers were coming in with,
oh, of course, right,
and souvenirs,
right.
Taking 70%, more than 70% of that plane was taken, was hauled away by souvenir hunters.
Wow.
So there a lot of evidence that the exact cause of that was never, you know, couldn't have been known because of those souvenir hunters.
Sure.
They took away vital evidence. But let's to get to your question, let's move up to January 7th, 1933. Father Reynolds is here in a bar, sitting here in a bar, sitting in South Bend in a bar, drinking with a couple of people. And he hears outside a newsboy saying, you know, bomb killed Rockne, put in play, you know, in by gang. And that was the South Bend News Times. And they said, retaliation for Father Reynolds. He said, read all about it, special edition. The underworld tried to kill Father Reynolds. And according to the South Bend New Times, and I'm quoting them, an unimpeachable source told the newspaper the Federal Secret Service was investigating reports that a bomb had caused the Fokker trimotor aircraft to crash and kill Rockne, five other passengers, and the two pilots. On January 6, 1933, a headline in the Washington Times.
Wait. That's where we'll pause it. We'll come back to that exact headline. And then what is, I maybe tantamount to a deathbed confession. I guess that's a slight exaggeration, but we'll fill in the blank on that coming up next on the potential murder of Knute Rockne on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponnett. So we'll get to the calls in just a second, but I want to wrap up this piece before we start getting other people into the conversation, if I can, with Jeff Harrell. By the way, Jeff, is this a book yet? Is this out? Because I know Rockne of Ages was the title, and you were working on it.
We are planning to be out before Christmas.
Okay, because I was trying to find it and I couldn't find it. So
you'll,
here's what
I will make sure you know when it's out. Believe me.
Okay, here's what I'll make, because you were so kind to do this in advance of the book coming out. When you get that information to me, I will very much look forward to mentioning it again, so that you get a little promotion before the before Christmas, so
thank
people don't
so
have
much
to remember this. So thank you for jumping on. Usually publishers don't like it when you get on too early before a book comes out, but I'm really glad you're doing this. So we were just talking about the headlines were coming out, and you were just talking about one more, and then I had to stop you before we.
The Santa Ana, California Register story said Secret Service operatives were in South Bend a few days ago rounding out their evidence and had it complete, even to the name of the man suspected of placing the bomb in a mail pouch in the plane. And that was the Register in its January 6, 1933 edition. Now, I got to wrap this thing up, I do have to say that we have the memo from J. Edgar Hoover. And I have heard that, you know, the people who have talked to me said, well, the FBI denied it. Well, not necessarily. What J. Edgar Hoover in his memo said was, I said we were not conducting any investigation of this insofar as I knew or had been advised, but that I understood the investigation was being made by the Commerce Department.
Hmm.
So there was a non-denial, basically.
Right.
Said in all the president's men. So.
But not with Father Reynolds. Fast forward the story to 1986, when this aged priest gets one more interview.
Ron Carkin, who I interviewed, and I also interviewed the Father Layton, who was at the Gethsemane Abbey out in Oregon, and knew Father Reynolds, who had gotten there in 1962. By the way, after Father Reynolds had gotten kicked out of the monastery that he founded in Utah for punching out a priest.
So he's kind of a renegade priest himself, this Father Reynolds.
Ian, I'm telling you, this book, you know, Knute Rockne is the crown jewel of this book, of course. But
right.
Let me tell you something. Father Reynolds is a story in himself. And I can't wait for the book to come out just to resurrect the spirit of this amazing priest. This guy was unbelievable.
Okay.
Anyway, he gave an interview to Ron Carkin like a few weeks before he died at the age of 91. Now, I asked Ron, the first question I asked Ron was, what kind of shape was he in? He says, his memory was clear. He said he was the most intelligent man he'd ever spoken to. And he was out there. I can't remember the name of the newspaper that he was, but it was a Christian paper out in Oregon. That he was reporting for, and he did this story on Father Reynolds, and we have the tapes. I have the taped interview. I've got both the transcripts and the taped interview with Father Reynolds.
What
and
a treasure!
He sounds like a priest who doubled as a gangster.
Right.
I mean, it almost sounds like you listen to Jimmy Cagney in Public Enemy Number One.
Funny, yeah. You know. But this priest, so here, I mean, how 6 decades later, 5 decades later, he's sticking with the story.
Absolutely.
That he believes 100% that the mob came after Knute Rockne because of him.
And his quote was, yes, absolutely, yes.
But, you know, so we have to follow this if we're going to make this connection, the mob from Chicago reached out to the Kansas City mob, perhaps because they were already very connected, the Kansas City mob and the Chicago mob. So that's not a stretch to think that they could have gotten an operative to get something on that plane.
No.
Or a stretch to think that somebody in the Kansas City mob could have leaned on some anonymous airport person to make sure that plane gets up. But why not just shoot him? I mean, why do we have a reason for why they want to take down 5 other innocent lives on that plane along with the crew? Was there any other reason why they did it that way as opposed to just, you know, making it seem like Knute Rockne was the victim of a random, mugging or something where that got out of control?
My educated guess, they planted I don't think it was a bomb more than an explosive device that was just going to weaken, that was going to explode, ignite, and weaken that part. It was a wooden plane. And just weakened that part of the plane, which is why the wings severed, which was the exact same way that another proven bomb that brought down a plane in 1933, about 3 months after these stories came out, a plane exploded over LaPorte, Indiana here that Melvin Purvis, the famous FBI agent, investigated. And it was almost the exact same thing, that they found a bomb that was set in a bathroom in the rear of the plane that just exploded enough to weaken that part of the wing where it severed. The rest of the plane went down, and it looked like an accident. And I think these guys, you know, they may have been, you know, they may have been not been the brightest lights in the room on most things, but when it came to murder and when it came to crime, these guys were geniuses. And Capone, by the way, had a guy named Bella Castro, who was his. He was called the Mad Bomber, and he during this time, and Bella, and this, Bella Castro was responsible for over 100 explosions that killed people, mostly most people who quit buying their alcohol from Capone. So they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, from what I know about the Capone story, and I've always found him interesting, I've read a lot about him, he was also very aware of what good and bad publicity could do for him, and that it still would have been bad PR for somebody like Capone to be linked to that murder of somebody as popular as Knute Rockne, especially being a Chicagoan, especially, although he wasn't born Catholic, he had converted to Catholicism and was connected to, you know, an institution like Notre Dame. So I could see it from that standpoint, that he would rather blow up a plane and make it look like an accident so that he doesn't have to, there wouldn't be any blowback, so to speak, on him.
Well, especially, you know, say that priest would have been on the plane, that then he would have had blood on his hands as a Catholic.
Right.
You know, so, but no, these guys knew what they were doing, and they were ruthless. They were absolutely ruthless.
So, I going back to where this conversation started, I still, in the end, I'm just not sure I understand why any Knute Rockne historian or anybody who is a proponent of Notre Dame, why they would be so afraid that we would be telling this story on the air. I just don't get it.
I think, well, for one, I kind of foresaw this coming even before, you know, when I first started this, and the main fear was that I think people are afraid that we're going to link Rockne with the mob. Nothing could be further from the truth. If anything, Rockne was an innocent victim. He was a totally innocent victim in this. You know, and Rockne was one of the most amazing men I've ever studied. And after doing the research that I have on him, I'm in awe of the man. I think the man is the most amazing figure this country has ever put out.
Yeah,
I mean, he was an amazing man, and if anything, if everything, you know, did piece together this way, then the fact that he died so needlessly is even more tragic than just dying in a plane crash. Because we were robbed of this amazing man before his time.
Even if he had never coached again. Right. I mean, even if he didn't come back for the 1931 season because of his failing health, he was already, as you say, he was a well-known speaker. He was going on. He was touring. He had many good years ahead of him of inspiring other people.
There were two figures during the tour. There was Babe Ruth and Knute Rockne. And Babe Ruth, as mighty as Babe Ruth was, intellectually, Knute Rockne left him in the dust.
Oh, of course, yeah. You know, I'm not sure I would have thought that was hard.
I would be remiss also. Knute Rockne actually shaped the football. He sold his football through. He's the one who put the first air valve in there to regulate air pressure, so it would fit more comfortably in the quarterback's hand for passing.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
We have all this on our website, KnuteRockne.com.
Okay, which I love the fact that you own that. So, KnuteRockne.com.
Yes.
And here's, I'm sure you know this story, but there's an interesting broadcast connection. So, when your book comes out and you do a lot more radio interviews like this, are you familiar with his connection to the famous Electro Voice microphone?
Vaguely.
Okay, so if people know the famous EIB microphone, the golden microphone from Rush Limbaugh, and one of the most well-known and well-used and well-respected microphones in broadcasting are these Electro Voices, and there's the RE20 and the RE27, and they're tanks, right? I mean, they last for a long time. They give you a great sound. Broadcasters love them because they have a very nice warm tone to them, and that the what we call the array, the way that the sound is arranged around the microphone, is it makes it really good for interviews and for two people talking at the same time. And so a room full of people, everybody using EVs, it sounds really good. Well, the Electro Voice was named by Knut Rockne, because up until at some point, I don't know what season it was, 26 or 27, he was still using the big cardboard megaphones when he was yelling out to the teams during practices. And the Electro Voice was being developed in South Bend, just outside of Chicago. And the guy who the people that developed it brought this PA system over to Notre Dame practice fields so that Knut could save his voice. Knut could save his voice and speak into the microphone with the speakers. And he's the one who started referring to it as, "Bring me my electronic voice. I want my electronic voice." And the company renamed itself Electro Voice in honor of that. And that name and that company and that everything still sticks from Knut Rockne in the practices. Isn't that cool? I love that story.
Fantastic. Well, you know, when he was during the 1930 season or the 1929 season, he was conducting practices from the back seat of a car, and he was using that Electro Voice, like you said, as a PA system to shout orders out to his players.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I talked. We talked ourselves into a corner here at the top of the hour, but we'll go to open lines on the way. Before we do, then, what are the missing pieces that you're still looking to find, in case? And this happens a lot on this show, as we often refer to it as, like, the evidence that still exists in the shoe boxes of histories, in houses all over the country. What would be an amazing find for you to help bring this story out of the sports legend category and into sports fact, 100% indisputable?
Well, let me ask you, the undisputable, I've always had one question after this. There was a passenger on that plane named H.J. Christian. H.J. Christian was, he was on his way to L.A. supposedly to reconcile with his estranged wife. He was an interior designer in Chicago. I mean, you know, I don't know how much he made. I don't know, 40, 50 bucks a week maybe. I mean, if Lingle was making 65 at the paper,
right.
I can't see this guy making much more than that. Why did this guy have $55,000 on him, supposedly on him, that he had cashed before he got on the plane, which was the exact amount that three newspapers had paid out in reward money a week before for the conviction capture and conviction of the killer of Jake Lingle, including the Chicago Tribune. And now the reason I bring that up is because the next day, the following day is when that was first reported on, what, April 1st, the day after the crash, was when that H.J. Christian, it was supposedly had $55,000, had cashed a $55,000 check before he got on that plane. How would the newspapers, in a day where there was only newspapers and radio, how would the newspapers know that he had that $55,000 on him unless they paid it to him? That's my question, because I've scoured the internet, scoured the earth to find out how he got that money, and that's really about the only question that I have left after this book.
Could it be then that they were really going after him and not after Knut Rockne?
I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question.
Or that it was a twofer. You know, that they get what a rare opportunity they have to literally kill, you know, two people with one stone. In this case, somebody that would really hurt Notre Dame. In the other case, you know, silence a stool pigeon.
And send a message to the priest who testified.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You've done some great work here, Jeff Harrell. Now, your co-author was John Davenport.
John Davenport. Yeah, he's my collaborator. In the middle of all of this, we have a posthumous autobiography compiled by John. John spent 15 years. And the photographs are unbelievable. And that section is called Rockne on Rockne. We have Rockne's life in his own words.
Okay, so you've got that out, so people can find that on Amazon. But this book, this coffee table book, which then chronicles, it has all these photographs that you've collected, are also on your website, KnutRockne.com. But the book is coming out in time for holiday gift giving.
Yes.
Okay, all right. That's the plan. And what's the publisher?
We are self-publishing right now.
Oh, you are?
We're laying it out, designing it, and everything, yeah.
Okay, but you'll get it out by then. Well, I'll promise you we'll get you back, at least in some form, to make sure that we promote that before the holidays, because it sounds great. Or get me a copy of it so that I can be talking about it. Okay, and then was there any one specific suspect that the FBI ever identified, or anybody else ever identified, that ties directly to this potential bombing of Knut Rockne?
Well, they had like I said, the California paper said that the Secret Service had a name.
Right.
But they never released the name.
They never released that name. I wonder whether it's possible that that's still in some archive somewhere.
I mean, it seems highly unlikely,
but who knows? Who absolutely knows on that? Thank you so much. Dude, you were wonderful. And thank you for making time for us.
Sir, I really appreciate it. You have a great weekend, and we will be in touch.
Wonderful. And we'll pick it up here coming up with Open Lines. We'll give you all the numbers after the top of the hour. And there's no one topic in mind. I think the booms that were happening around cities is interesting, but it looks like we've got the one that was around Wichita solved, at least for now. But you don't have to go there. It's Open Lines, and we like to prove that by just seeing how far open we can blow this show. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett.